You are listening to the Bottom Line podcast, where those living with or beyond bowel cancer, as well as health professionals involved in bowel cancer treatment and care, share their inspirational stories and lived experiences with host and bowel cancer survivor, Stephanie.
In your 20s, you should be living life to the full, perhaps exploring the world, experiencing love, or starting your career. But for today's guest, these dreams came to an abrupt halt as she faced a stage 4 bowel cancer diagnosis at 27. Now in her early 30s, Taylor joins us on the Bottom Line podcast to chat about her diagnosis and the impact it had on her life. Taylor, welcome to the Bottom Line podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you've certainly been through the ringer over the past 5 to 6 years. Diagnosed in your 20s with bowel cancer is just something that's very brutal. Can you talk us through your initial diagnosis?
I was diagnosed when I was 27 with stage 4 bowel cancer. At the time, I didn't get the staging straight away. My symptoms were very acute by the time I presented to my local GP to figure out what was going on, why I was having these symptoms that were becoming quite concerning because they'd been going on for about 4 months. I'd been having really bad acid reflux that couldn't be controlled even with, you know, the over-the-counter tablets that you can get. And I'd also been having really bad abdominal pain to the point where I would feel like I was going to pass out. And I thought, you know, this is becoming quite extreme. It's not something that is normal. To be honest, though, I did not expect bowel cancer.
It's something people don't expect in young people, but particularly in your 20s, that's very young.
Yeah, at 27, it was definitely not something that we were expecting at all. And so it really was a huge shock.
A stage 4 diagnosis, you said you weren't diagnosed stage 4 till a little later, but what was the outcome? What treatment regime and at what point were you staged?
I had surgery 3 days after I was diagnosed. In between that, I had a colonoscopy and an endoscopy. So that was on the 17th of December. And then by the 30th of December, I was having a follow-up visit with my surgeon. And that's when I was given the stage 4C diagnosis. So I have to commend the public health system in that regard, that even though it was the Christmas period and I'm sure they were very busy, they still got the results back to me in what I now consider a very prompt manner. Obviously, at the time, those two and a bit weeks were just absolutely...
Time stands still sometimes, Taylor, doesn't it?
And yes.
Yet then in other situations, it seems to go rapidly. You lose some sense of time when you have cancer.
Yes. And so after that, it was how quickly can we find a spot for you to get you started on chemotherapy? So taking into account that also I had to actually recover from surgery, you can't go straight into chemo. It was 6 weeks after my surgery that I started chemotherapy, and in that point I had a portacath fitted. I'd been in and had my initial meeting with my oncologist, signed all my permission paperwork, and, you know, had all the initial stuff, met with a fertility preservation specialist to talk about those options.
Which I think is really important, Taylor, too, because we talk about early onset being in the rush hour of life. You were really at the start of, you know, career, family, those sorts of things. Fertility is a very important factor, isn't it?
It is an extremely important factor, and it wasn't actually something that was considered straight away. I think because everyone who was involved at that point in my care team were probably playing catch up in terms of their priorities. So their immediate priority was obviously for me to have the surgery. And then it was to make sure that I was recovering okay with no complications and that I was starting chemotherapy as soon as possible. And none of the people on my team had ever had a bowel cancer case in someone of my age. They'd unfortunately treated several teenagers with leukemia, but had not ever had a patient in their 20s with cancer. So it was definitely almost an afterthought, I would say, the fertility stuff, which it is actually really important to have those conversations because there are so many different options available now thanks to medical advancements, and some of them do take time. And for me, time was very short and time was of the essence. And I essentially had 24 hours to make a decision about what I wanted to do, and that was to delay starting chemotherapy by 2 weeks so that I could do an egg preservation cycle.
Which is a very hard decision, having done IVF myself and also had bowel cancer at 42. It's very different to somebody in their 20s who is not yet married, hasn't probably really forward thought, knew they wanted children. So, you know, only having that short period, as well as being lumped with a stage 4 diagnosis, an immediate surgery, upheaval out of your own home and not having a lot of family around you. That's a massive amount of weight on your shoulders, Taylor.
Yeah, it was just everything just blurred together, which sounds very cliche, but everything was happening so quickly and all the people involved in my medical care were doing their absolute best, but it just felt like I had no time at all to be making these potentially life-altering decisions. Making the decision to not do fertility preservation, knowing that that could mean that I could never have children. There's so much unknown, not knowing what my fertility levels were like before I even started chemotherapy, let alone doing anything to help preserve them for the future. And I basically had to make that decision as soon as possible. So I made the decision to not do fertility preservation and to start chemotherapy as soon as possible. I couldn't deal with the thought of delaying chemotherapy by 2 weeks and what that could potentially mean for me. The way I justified it to myself was, well, I can't have children if I'm dead.
And everyone's unique and everyone faces challenges in a different way, don't they? So there's no right and wrong here. And then you started chemotherapy, obviously, and that was successful for a little while. Talk us through the chemotherapy piece and then we'll come to the clinical trial that you accessed.
Chemotherapy was successful probably for the first 3 months. So I had my first 6 rounds of chemotherapy and it seemed like everything was going okay. I had scans done, a CT scan done after those first 6 rounds, after that first 3 months, and it had been really tough, as I'm sure anyone who's had chemotherapy would understand, physically and emotionally. And so we were quite happy when I had that CT and the results came back and they said nothing has changed. Essentially, the chemotherapy kept things at bay for a little while, but given I had so much lymph node involvement, even though those cancerous lymph nodes were removed, it was kind of only holding things back for as long as it took my body to find a way around the chemotherapy, essentially. And once it did, the way my oncologist now explains it is it was kind of like opening a floodgate. So there'd been all this pressure building up behind it from all these cancerous cells sitting in my lymphatic system. And the second it found a way to outsmart the chemotherapy, it just went absolutely haywire and it just spread very rapidly and very aggressively. So that explains the lower back pain. And the hardest thing about that was that my oncologist at the time said, well, there's really no other options available for you. It's quite obvious that chemotherapy, you know, this is the strongest, the harshest chemotherapy we have for bowel cancer, which is the FOLFOX combination with the oxaliplatin, which anyone who's had that would know it's quite cytotoxic, quite hard on the body. And they said, you know, essentially you've had the strongest chemotherapy you can have. So if this hasn't worked, any other chemotherapy combinations that we give you is only going to be to try and delay any further growth or spread. And given how quickly things have moved between things being okay and things being really bad, we're not looking at a positive outcome.
So this is where the clinical trial then came in for you, Taylor, wasn't it? I think clinical trials, for anyone, it is a maze. And, you know, when not everyone is medically literate, how did this global trial come about? Was it you being proactive or did someone bring it to you? Talk us through that process, because you were one of 40 Australians as part of this global trial.
Yeah, so when we got given that news, my oncologist said, realistically, I think there's only two options for you. I don't think doing any further chemotherapy other than what we would call palliative chemotherapy is a realistic goal. Things just aren't going to make a difference, essentially. So right now we would be looking at keeping you comfortable and prolonging things for as long as we can so that you can get your affairs in order, to use that terrible phrase.
Taylor, at your age as well, I mean, let's be honest, if you're 70 or 80, it's awful, but you've had a life, you were beginning your life. That must have been incredibly difficult, and we'll come to the mental component in a moment, but wow.
Yes, it was extremely confronting. So when she said, well, there is another option, I just remember thinking anything, I will do anything. And she said, I can see if there is a clinical trial available that you may be eligible for, where would you like me to look? And I said, I will go anywhere. I will go anywhere in Australia. I will go overseas. I will do anything. It doesn't matter. If there is even the smallest chance that there's a clinical trial that I may be eligible for, that I may be accepted onto, let's try.
So the clinical trial, she was looking in the other public health systems within Queensland. And how did this global one come up?
As part of those referrals to other hospitals, one of those referrals was to the Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane, purely because it's one of the largest hospitals in the Queensland public health system, if not the largest. And the oncology team was having their monthly multidisciplinary team meeting. And one of the oncologists who was sitting in on the multidisciplinary team meeting when my case was discussed was quite a young oncologist at the time. And he actually said, I've just been given the go-ahead to start recruiting for this trial, which is being run globally. We've been given approval to run it here at the PA, the Australian arm of this trial. And based on what I'm seeing here, I think Taylor could be a candidate. So let's let her know. And so my oncologist at the time, she called me and she said, there's a chance that you could be eligible for this. How soon can you get to Brisbane? And I said, like, we'll leave today, you know. And so we left the next day. We drove the 12 hours down to Brisbane, and I went and had a meeting, an initial meeting with him, my current oncologist, and he explained to me that this was not a sure thing. There was a lot of hoops that I would have to jump through, because the thing with clinical trials is they're looking for very specific test subjects, essentially.
You have to fit, you've got to tick a lot of boxes, don't you?
Yeah. You've got to tick a lot of boxes, and that may seem very unfair to people on the outside, but you're talking about a scientific experiment. And so he said, you know, I need you to understand that I can put you forward for this trial. You can do all the things that you need to do, which is get blood tests, get scans. We'll have to send a bit of your tumor over to the drug company's lab in Florida. They'll have to do their own testing in an accredited lab to get the same results we've done here in Australia, to make sure you have the right mutations that we're looking for as part of this trial. And you could do all that, and they may come back and say no. I'd been off treatment for about 4 weeks, chemotherapy, and I could feel my body was starting to shut down, essentially. I was in agonizing pain all the time, because all my organs and my soft tissue and my lymphatic system were filled with tumors. So by this point, I just said to him, look, I don't care. I don't care if they come back and say that I'm not a candidate. We have to try.
It was the only real option you had, wasn't it, Taylor?
Yeah.
Really? Well, the alternative was not one you wanted to face.
No. And I suppose, you know, it's natural. You want to try everything. You want to try everything that's available to you before you say, okay, well, I tried everything and there's nothing else.
So you obviously got through and onto the trial, which is amazing. Talk us through the trial and the drugs and how that worked.
So it was a very agonizing 6-week wait, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Oh, wow. That would have felt more like 6 months, I would have thought.
Yes. I remember I got a call at 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon, and they said, we just heard that you've been accepted. How soon can you be here? I said, we never left.
I've got goosebumps, Taylor.
Yeah. I said, we're here. We're in Brisbane. And they said, can you be here at 9 o'clock tomorrow? And I said, yes. Obviously, everyone was very keen to get me started straight away. And things just moved incredibly quickly. That first round that I had was quite tough. I was in a lot of pain afterwards, even more so than what I had been in. And I called the clinical trials nurse, the head nurse, to just say I was concerned and what should I do. And he said, I'll speak to your oncologist and I'll call you back. And he called me back and he said, this is actually good news, because the way that immunotherapy works is if your body is going to accept the treatment, it will have an inflammatory response. So essentially, this drug's coming in, it's attacking your immune system, and your immune system, if it's doing what it should be, will suddenly go on alert and go, oh my goodness, what's happening? You know, we all systems go, and it will have that inflammatory response where it will try and fight back against the foreign body, the immunotherapy. But what it actually does, thanks to immunotherapy, is it starts to fight back against the cancer.
Mm.
So he said, this is the best news possible. Like, the very next day after that first round, you're having this response. This is great. This is what we want to be happening.
Can I take a step backwards for a sec, Taylor? What was the immunotherapy drugs that you were on?
The trial that I was on was... it was a blind assignment, and there were three different arms. One arm was continuing with chemotherapy. One arm was a mono immunotherapy, a drug called nivolumab. And then the third arm was a dual immunotherapy, which was two drugs, ipilimumab and nivolumab.
Which is the one you were on?
Yeah, which is very, very luckily, fingers crossed, we were all holding our breath when we opened the envelope. Yes, that was the arm that I got assigned to, was the dual immunotherapy. And we were all very excited because, you know, obviously the more you can throw at it, the better.
Mm. How quickly did it start to turn around for you?
I had my first CT scan after two rounds of immunotherapy, so after 4 weeks of treatment, and that was the parameters set by the trial. So four weekly CT scans, two weekly treatments to start with. And from that very first scan, we could see a difference in terms of swelling. So immediately my oncologist said, you're internally, you're not as swollen as you were. Your organs aren't as swollen. You're not carrying as much excess fluid. So this is a good thing because it means that your immune system is starting to recover, essentially, from the damage that has been done by chemotherapy and by having cancer, essentially. But in terms of tangible, we're getting very excited, this is actually really working results. I started the trial at the end of September 2020, and in February 2021. So I'd done a few rounds by then, had a few different scans. That scan, my oncologist compared it to my first scan that I had done before I started the trial, when I originally had to send all my stuff away. And he said, the spots that we're targeting to measure, because you've just got so much cancer, it's impossible. We have to just pick certain spots to measure against. You've had a 65% reduction in size.
Wow. And that was about 4 or 5 months, if I do my math right.
Yeah. Hmm. So it was incredibly quick. It, to be honest, it shocked everyone. And that was probably that point where I started to feel very cautiously hopeful. It hadn't been smooth sailing up until that point. Since I'd been on the trial, the ipilimumab, after my third round, I was hospitalized with encephalitis and I was in hospital for 9 days and I was not lucid or conscious at all during that time. And it was on the sixth or seventh day, my oncologist said, everyone needs to come down because I don't think she's actually going to be able to pull through. So it hadn't been smooth sailing, that's for sure. It started out really well. Then, you know, as I said earlier, ipilimumab is just an extremely cytotoxic drug. And I was just so, my body was just under siege, essentially, that it just couldn't cope. But I did pull through, thank goodness, and recovered enough that I was able to do my fourth and final round of the ipilimumab and then continue on the mono immunotherapy, just the nivolumab.
And how long was that for?
The mono is for a further 20 rounds. So it's 24 rounds in total, 4 rounds of both drugs and 20 rounds of one drug, and the whole trial takes about 2 years roughly.
And at what point did they, Taylor, say to you, this has been a success?
From that February, I'd had so much reduction, the 65% of what they were measuring, that at that point, I recall my oncologist saying, if nothing else changes beyond this point, this is an incredible result. And you're at a point now where I feel that you are as medically stable as you can be, given, you know, you've got stage 4 cancer and all this other stuff. You can do it. The point that the trial coordinators, I guess, started to agree with him was probably around the 12-month mark, so September that year, September 2020, which is when my markers, those different spots of cancer that they were measuring, hadn't changed for about 2 months. So they'd gotten really small, down to like 3 millimeters, 2 millimeters from 20 millimeters. And they'd been that way for about 2 months. And they said, that means essentially that they're as small as they're going to get. We're talking now about 2 millimeters, and anything under 10 is considered, for like a lymph node, is considered normal. So they said, it's sitting at 2. It's been there like that for 2 months. I don't think it's going to get any smaller. So either that means we've gone as far as we can, or that 2 millimeters is actually scar tissue. And the way the trial works is essentially, as I said earlier, they control things very strictly in terms of their data outputs. So it was just business as usual. I've signed up for a 2-year trial. No harm, no foul. Just continue going for those infusions, for those treatments. At this point, I was going every 4 weeks. I was having scans every 6 weeks, and we'll just keep going. And then it got to May 2022. I was due to finish the trial the day before my 30th birthday in August. And my oncologist said, okay, let's send you for your end of trial PET scan. So I'd only been having CTs at this point. I hadn't had a PET scan since that one when they said, when my first oncologist had given me the awful news that things had spread everywhere. He said, I feel confident now to do a PET scan. Your measurements have not changed for 8 months. Let's have a look and see what we're dealing with. And I went back and saw him after the PET scan, and he said, we cannot find anything. He said, you have what we would call in this setting, given what you've been through, you've had a complete metabolic response to this treatment. There is no evidence of cancer anywhere. What has been consistently showing up on your scans is actually scar tissue and calcified tumors, because you had such large tumors, you had such large areas of cancer, that even though it's shrunk, there is going to be some scar tissue left behind, because, you know, it's just impossible. It's impossible to grind a boulder into anything more than powder, if that makes sense. You can't make a boulder disappear. It was so big. You can only make it so small.
Absolutely. So, Taylor, as we've said, clinical trials can be very confusing. What would be your advice for others who might find themselves in a similar situation and wanting to explore clinical trials?
The most important thing is to listen to your oncologist and the advice that they give you. If they have been chosen to participate in a clinical trial as a clinician, they already have a level of depth and understanding that other oncologists don't. Often people are oncologists that are selected to participate in clinical trials as a clinician are called research oncologists. So they're often already an oncologist who is doing further work in the space of cancer care. So whether they're writing scientific papers, whether they're presenting at conferences about new techniques they've been using, new things that they have discovered. So they often have a lot of understanding and can portray it to you in a way that makes it easier for you as an average person to be able to digest. If you feel that it's something that would benefit you and that you would be able to get your head around, you can also ask your oncologist to provide you some further reading material about the clinical trial in particular, or the drugs and things that are happening in that space, so that you can get a little bit of a better understanding of what to expect, what work has already been done, what the trial so far has shown. So obviously that's not applicable for people who are doing a stage one trial in terms of results so far, but there should be further reading material available to you beyond the consent paperwork that you sign is normally quite extensive. There should be further reading materials, supporting materials that they can provide you about the company manufacturing the drugs, the company sponsoring the trial, and that sort of thing. For me, I found that very useful. And I think when you're, as a cancer patient, moving into that space where you really are at the forefront of medical research, it can be quite empowering to find out as much information as you possibly can and to feel a sense of control in a situation where you have very little control in general.
So, Taylor, these drugs that you were on as part of your clinical trial have just been listed on the PBS. How important is this decision for other bowel cancer patients?
Immunotherapy as a cancer treatment is the way of the future. It should be the gold standard. It should be the frontline treatment for all cancer patients moving forward. Personally, I know of at least two people who have passed since I was diagnosed, that were diagnosed around the same time that I was, who would still be alive today if they had had the opportunity to access these drugs. Not everyone gets accepted onto clinical trials, and that's the reality. As we discussed earlier, there's very tight parameters that have to be met. And it's almost cruel to think, when it comes down to its basest element, that people have to jump through these hoops to access life-saving treatment. So the fact that that treatment is now available on the PBS, which means that it can now be the first line of treatment for people who meet those parameters for that type of immunotherapy. It just opens up a whole new avenue for colorectal patients. There's tens of thousands of people worldwide that will now be able to live who previously, the options up until now have been palliative chemotherapy for nothing other than to try and keep you comfortable, or hope that everything lines up and it just happens to be the perfect timing that there's a trial available that you can be accepted onto, to just essentially walk into that door and say, okay, you're going to go on these drugs now. It might seem that it takes quite a long time to people who aren't really involved in this space, but for me, that is an incredible turnaround. You know, we're talking 5 years. Five years since I started this treatment initially, to today. And in that time frame, we've gone from only being able to access those drugs on a clinical trial if you're lucky enough, to it's just now available like any other cancer treatment.
Yes, it's certainly a step forward. And in the medical world, it can take decades sometimes. I want to talk to you a little bit about the impact on your life. You touched on it before that you're not able to work full time anymore. So can you talk me through, you know, how you got through that piece of the puzzle?
That piece of the puzzle, as you put it, was probably the most difficult piece of the puzzle for me, which probably seems quite odd to some people, because for other people it may be, you know, just the fact of having stage four cancer alone and confronting the concept of dying in your 20s, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, the most difficult thing was my sense of identity, which is something I had to dig into, which I'll discuss in a minute. But my sense of identity had always been tied to feeling as though I had a purpose in life, and that that purpose was to be a productive member of society, to be a good sister, a good daughter, a good aunt, a good cousin, a reliable employee, someone who volunteered in their spare time, you know, all those sort of things were absolutely inherent to my identity and as a person and my sense of purpose. And I clung on to that for as long as I could while I was having chemotherapy, working on the off weeks, as we say, the week that we aren't having treatment, until it got to the point where I actually physically could not get out of bed and mentally could barely string a sentence together, let alone concentrate on work. Up until that point, I had been coping okay mentally despite everything. But at that point, everything just completely unraveled. And that's when I asked if I could be referred to a mental health specialist who specialized in working with cancer patients. And I do think that's very important. I think that's an important caveat for people who are undergoing cancer treatment, is to find a psychologist. And luckily, many treatment centers today, whether those are public hospitals, whether they're private hospitals, wherever you're having your treatment, many of them have connections to mental health specialists who work in the cancer space. They just have a much greater understanding of all the nuances than a normal mental health specialist would. And it took almost 2 years, I would say, of monthly visits with that psychologist to actually work through all the issues that were brought up as a point of losing my sense of purpose and my sense of identity.
You're grieving, aren't you, in a way? You're grieving for what could have been and what was.
That's exactly what it was.
I can't imagine what you were going through, and at such a young age when you've got your entire life ahead of you.
It's extremely difficult, I think, and this is a conversation that I know you and I and other early onset advocates have had, and early onset patients. It's so difficult to properly articulate just how different having cancer in your 20s is, even from having it in your 40s, let alone having it under 50 compared to over 50. There's so many different things to consider. And unfortunately, other than, you know, specialist or organisations like Bowel Cancer Australia, the general support just is not there.
No. Taylor, we're getting very close to the end, but before I ask my three key questions, where are you at now and how are you doing?
I had my most recent CT scan at the end of October this year, And it has confirmed that I am still, for lack of a better description, no evidence of disease. So that marks 3.5 years now that I've been no evidence of disease.
Fantastic.
We have had a little bit of a wobble recently in the fact that I have had a new 10 millimeter spot thing pop up on my liver between my scan in April and my scan in October. But I have had an MRI to look at it further. And for now, it doesn't look cancerous. It's not behaving in the same way that my other cancer did. It's not a setback per se. I think it just more so highlights how important it is to continue to have regular monitoring. I'm at a point now where I feel comfortable with my new identity and my new sense of purpose.
And we must also say you do work, you advocate with us at Bowel Cancer Australia and come to call on Canberra, which is amazing, and help us out when we need the advocacy.
Yeah. I think for me, that's a really important part of that new sense of purpose and that new identity is I find myself very passionate and feeling very compelled to give back in any way that I can in that space. And for me, given what we've discussed today, a lot of that takes the form of trying to push for better care and what that and all that entails for people with young onset bowel cancer and colorectal cancer in general.
And you do a wonderful job. Taylor, thank you so much for chatting to me today. Before we go, I always ask my guests the three key points they want others to take away from today's podcast. And what would your three snapshots be?
The first snapshot and the most important one that I tell everyone is to be confident in being a staunch advocate for your own health. The second thing, and this is a practical, very entirely practical, once you begin working in any capacity as an adult, please ensure that you have either a form of income protection or you have a method available to support you should you be off work for an extended period of time. The third thing I would say is to make sure that you get mental health support as early in your journey as possible. I dislike that word journey.
But so do really, I. But sometimes there's not another word.
There's really no other way to describe it.
Yeah, chaos.
If I was to do things again, I would seek out that help earlier. Even though I felt that I was coping okay, and for all intents and purposes, I probably was, by the time it came to the point where I needed that help, there was already quite a lot to be unpacked and a lot of things that I already had to deal with before I could start focusing on what was really at the core of what was bothering me, which, as I said, was my lack of purpose and the effect on my sense of worth and identity. So I don't think it can be understated how important it is to have that support.
Absolutely, Taylor. All of those points are incredibly wonderful tips. Thank you so much. I know it's been a long podcast, but I think it's been a really beneficial one. I've been wanting to do this with you for a long time and we've finally got it done. Thank you so much. What an inspiration you are. What a joy you are to be around. And the work that you do and your giving back is wonderful. So, Taylor, thank you so much today for joining me on the Bottom Line podcast.
Thanks for having me, Steph.
Thank you so much for listening to the Bottom Line podcast. To find out more about bowel cancer or for support or simply to donate, please go to bowelcanceraustralia.org.